Welcome to Street Spirit,
social justice news and homeless blues in the San Francisco Bay Area at www.thestreetspirit.org. I'm Jess Clark, your podcast host today, and we're joined by Terry Messman, founder of Street Spirit and the director of Project Hope. We're going to be talking about the history and origins of Street Spirit and some of the important political trends in homeless organizing and advocacy of human rights in the Bay Area. So, Terry, just getting a big picture, why did you first found Street Spirit?
Well, we put out the first issue in March of 1995, so we've been going steadily for more than 20 years now. It's one of the most long-lived media of any kind that have documented the history of poverty, homelessness, and economic injustice. We founded it because I had been an activist for many years on homeless issues in Oakland and Berkeley, doing housing takeovers, mobilizing homeless people to demonstrate at welfare offices and other human rights struggles for their rights. And we got a lot of positive media attention, but I was more and more concerned that the corporate media was completely denigrating poor and homeless people. It was kind of a form of character assassination in the news columns, and we got really fed up with that. So a friend of mine, Sally Heineman, who I'd known at seminary in Berkeley, and who was also working on homeless issues in Oakland, advocated that I begin Street Spirit because she knew of my background in journalism. I graduated with a BA in journalism. So we put out the first issue. I was the editor, and Sally Heineman organized the first team of homeless vendors that sell the newspaper on the streets.
So prior to that, you've been doing Project Hope, which I understand was a homeless organizing project. And what was kind of the reason behind switching out of direct organizing with homeless people, building housing, advocating for policy change in a direct organizing methodology to this other level of media?
Well, we didn't really switch out. I had been doing housing takeovers and other forms of civil disobedience in Oakland and Berkeley. And then I moved over to work with Sister Bernie Galvin in San Francisco, a religious witness with homeless people. And I was instrumental in organizing all the protests in the first few years. Bernie Galvin's a brilliant community organizer. We worked in partnership, and we were organizing to protest the Matrix program, which was initiated by Mayor Frank Jordan, who had just been chief of police in San Francisco. And he unleashed the police in full fury against homeless people. So Sister Bernie organized all of these clergy and religious people to do civil disobedience, and I helped her organize those actions. In the middle of that, we realized how crucial the media was, because the San Francisco Chronicle, for instance, had an incredibly arch reactionary position on homeless people. It was just amazing to me to see how unfair they were, how they ignored protests, how they berated and beat up on homeless people in their editorial columns. So we agreed that forming a media would enhance the direction of and the emphasis of homeless organizing. So when I began Street Spirit, I was still working basically full-time with Religious Witness. As the years went on, Street Spirit took over my entire life and program work at the American Friends Service Committee.
So it was an evolutionary process. So through the 90s, It was a hybrid project.
Yeah. And actually, Paul Bowden of the Coalition on Homelessness, when I consulted with him about whether we should launch Street Spirit, because I knew it would take a lot of time, he told me that their Street Sheet newspaper was the single most important tool in their arsenal, the single most powerful. And he said, you're not going to be sorry. So as Street Spirit began taking over my life, I wasn't sorry because I saw the great power it had and the meaning it had.
So how, at that time, I know Street Sheet was being sold out of San Francisco, north of Market, and the Tenderloin areas. And why did you think another street paper was necessary? Why not just sell that paper around the Bay Area?
Because they were focused in San Francisco, and we wanted to cover issues in Oakland, Berkeley, and further inland in Contra Costa County, Concord, and Richmond. we felt those issues were vital. Those were the issues I knew the most. I'd been based in the East Bay, not in San Francisco. So Street Spirit was formed to cover those issues, and the Coalition on Homelessness was really glad we were doing that, because there hadn't been a paper there. And we based Street Spirit, even though it's a very different newspaper, we very much followed the model of the Coalition on Homelessness, because I think it's the best model in the country, that the paper, A, is hard-hitting advocacy journalism that never apologizes for being on the side of homeless and poor people. B, accepts no advertising, because advertising can really distort editorial freedom and independence. And C, we give it for free to homeless vendors, unlike virtually all of the other homeless newspapers in this country and in Europe, who all charge their vendors. The Street Sheet in San Francisco and my Street Spirit in the East Bay has always been given for free to our vendors. So when people buy it, they know the homeless person is getting all of the money. It's like economic redistribution from the middle class commuter to the homeless people, and no nonprofit gets a cent from it.
So I can talk a little more about that, because I think that people haven't really recognized the amount of media that's getting distributed on the street. It's sort of, it's an invisible, even though people see the vendors, they don't see it as a news channel. They don't realize 20, 30,000 copies of each of these papers is actually. Can you talk a little more about the vendors and what the impact is on the reading audience when you're buying a paper from a homeless person on the street?
Well, we wanted the vendors to sell them, so we should distribute it at libraries and at newsstands, because it would get out in the public more and be seen more as a, quote, legitimate news source, unquote. But we have felt from the beginning that a different model was important. The vendors sell it because we want everyone who buys it to have a one-on-one encounter with a homeless person, hoping that it'll begin to erode this terrible division in American society between homeless people and the general public. Everyone has to buy it from a homeless vendor. And it's also modeled on the early days when a revolution was brewing, in the early days of America, when that's very much always been my model. Thomas Paine distributed revolutionary pamphlets through street vendors on the street corners to get the word out that we needed a revolution against England. And Common Sense and all of his other great writings were distributed that way. And we feel that that's important for us, because we want to get out of the corporate chokehold on publishing. If you publish a normal magazine or newspaper, you're dealing with corporate advertisers, corporate media, and corporate stores that sell these things. And we just want nothing to do with any of that. So that's always been our vision. The problem is that, in a sense, we do excellent reporting. Street Spirit is as well edited, well written, and laid out as well as any newspaper there is. But the general public doesn't respect it as much as another publication, simply because if a newspaper is sold by homeless people, then all their bias against homeless people kind of carries over to the newspaper. And they look at it as a poverty publication and not a real publication, and that's their loss. It's just the blindness that afflicts American society in general about homeless people is passed on to us. Nobody in the middle class thinks homeless people are worthwhile.
No, nobody might be a little strong.
Well, almost nobody, believe me. I've been out there, and there aren't many. And they think that homeless people are a blight or an eyesore. That's why cities criminalize them, and why cities attempt to criminalize homeless newspapers.
Well, thanks for joining us, and we'll be right back with more from Terry Messman at thestreetspirit.org. This is Jess Clark, your podcast host today. We'll just have a quick musical break, and we'll be right back with more from Terry Messman on advocacy journalism in the U.S. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, I say everybody wanna know why I sing the blues. Well, I've been around a long time.
Okay, well, we're back, and we're going to be hearing from Terry Messman on advocacy journalism. Thanks for joining us at thestreetspirit.org. Terry.
Well, let me go back. You talked about
the American Revolution. I'm interested also in the historical continuity of different kinds of advocacy journalism over time. You know, the abolitionist papers, I know, were also not probably welcomed by, right, by a lot of the community. Maybe you could talk about some of the other historical antecedents, because I think one of the things that people can come to appreciate is that this is a subversive form of journalism that is actually has a real deep political intent that is fused the process of its sale, the content, the restrictions on it being supported by advertisers and corporate controllers of speech are part of an integral political perspective about social change. So if you can talk a little about the civil rights struggles of the 19th century, anti-slavery struggles, how you see this effort now fitting into the history of the left press, the alternative press, the resistance press. Now we're in the 21st century. It's a long, long ride since a penny press was what, a penny newspaper was the main means of communication.
Well, there is a long and really beautiful history of advocacy journalism and radical social justice journalism in this country. I can tell you, I went to a very good journalism school for 4 years, and you never hear about it. Today, the only form of journalism is so-called objective journalism, where the reporter pretends to not have a conscience, and that's ridiculous. Every reporter has a point of view and a conscience, but they're not supposed to. And basically, there's a corporate bias in all newspapers today. That's what their bias is. They don't attack very hard the Wall Street system and the bankers and the Pentagon and the White House. They're part of that system, and that is their bias, but they don't acknowledge it. So to do advocacy journalism in this country, the first thing they'll say is that's not legitimate because you're not objective. And no, we're not. We're on the side of poor and homeless people. We see a great injustice being done. We see historic levels of violations of human rights that would not be tolerated for any other minority. And those human rights violations are being unleashed on homeless people, and the mainstream media just doesn't get it. So our advocacy journalism is important, and as you said, it has long roots. I look back at Thomas Paine and his pamphlets and Common Sense as a great inspiration. An even greater inspiration for me has been William Lloyd Garrison and his fiery abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, and the way that he attacked the system of slavery in his news columns in such a profound way that there were often riots of pro-slavery forces when he spoke. They often laid siege to William Lloyd Garrison and the other abolitionist reporters and attacked them physically because the pro-slavery forces saw how powerful these kinds of advocacy newspapers were. Another great example from that same era is Ida B. Wells, who was a crusading African-American writer and editor who published an expose of lynching in the South and went around the country denouncing lynching. And she again was attacked and had to find the courage to keep telling people that lynching was a massive crime and had to be ended, and the way to end it was to give a voice to its victims. And I really take that to heart today. The way to end human rights violations against homeless people is to give a voice to its victims. And then on into the 20th century, there are all these beautiful models of advocacy journalism. There's all these wonderful writers that took on Standard Oil, that took on the American big business. There's, there's exposés in The Jungle by Upton Sinclair of the meatpacking industry that created reforms. In England, Charles Dickens was an advocacy journalist through his novels. He got untold reforms of child labor laws and poorhouse abuses through his work. And then on in this country, during the Civil Rights era, there were wonderful crusading advocacy journalists that risked everything to tell the truth. And then my generation, the anti-war movement of the 1960s, had an incredible array of underground newspapers in dozens of cities all over the country that were a mouthpiece for the counterculture and also denounced the war machine of Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, spoke out for civil rights, spoke out for human liberation. And when those were silenced, when those underground newspapers were silenced, a really terrible thing happened. About the only legacy or children of the underground newspapers of the 60s for a long time were these weekly papers that are basically doing a lot of yuppie reporting on gourmet restaurants and books and things, and have a lot of advertising and a little bit of political reporting. And I'm not going to name their names because it's just...
Most of them gone under.
Yeah, most of them have gone under too. So I really see the resurgence of the homeless press as a very wonderful reawakening of that spirit of advocacy journalism coming from the least likely place in society, the place where people have seemingly been silenced by poverty, but they have not. They're not voiceless, and the homeless press is not voiceless.
Yeah, so on the content side, I mean, coming out of the civil rights era, civil rights, human rights, the human rights of homeless people have very direct connections, and there's a huge African-American population that's homeless. And with the upsurge of activism in the past, you know, several years, as young African-Americans and young people in general are becoming more politically conscious, they're ready actually to receive, and they're looking for alternative information in new ways. And I'm wondering, what are the issues and the continuing coverage that you're going to be bringing to this new millennial audience, to the Black Lives Matter audiences, to the engaged, young, uninformed, ahistorical, and really passionate activists who are, you know, coming of age, mm-hmm. and they're in their teens and 20s and 30s.
Well, that's been a remarkable development. I mean, who would have predicted that? Everyone thought that young people were apolitical and were buying into the consumer society, and instead, beginning with the Occupy movement, continuing to the Black Lives movement, all the movements that have risen up against police brutality and police murders, all these things are incredible, heartening examples of the human spirit. And they show us that organizing is never defeated. It never, ever will stop. As long as there are human beings, there will be human rights movements. And that's what I love about it. In terms of street spirit, our job is not to be an all-purpose movement paper. Our job is to do what seemingly no one else in society wants to do, which is to stay covering poverty, homelessness, disability rights. Even movement people generally ignore those issues. So we could be more popular if we did more stuff on the peace movement or the environmental movement, but we have stubbornly for 20 plus years focused our efforts on giving poor people a voice because they get it nowhere else in society. And yet still there are many connections, as you say, between Black Lives Matter, the anti-police abuse movements, and the Occupy movement. So when the Occupy movement began, we did article after article covering that in a positive way, virtually every month. We interviewed people about Occupy and what kinds of nonviolent strategizing might enhance its ability to affect the powers that be. I went on the Occupy marches and was just amazed and overjoyed, even though there wasn't a great sense of strategy, there was a great sense of vital anti-corporate populist economic rights kind of organizing from very young people. It was wonderful. So we gave it a lot of coverage. The same with the Black Lives Matter movement. We are constantly covering the criminalization of poverty, the way that poor people are turned into criminals, and many of the same patterns in law enforcement that turn African Americans into criminals and treat them as criminals also are in play against poor people to treat them as criminals. So we speak out against that kind of political repression. We've covered many demonstrations, and we're in the current issue. We have a long, great article by Carol Denny, who covers the Police Review Commission hearings in Berkeley that look at why the police erupted in fury against the Black Lives Matter demonstration in Berkeley in December of 2014. We've covered that over and over. So in those areas where the criminalization of poverty meets the criminalization of other people in society, street spirit covers those issues. The other thing that we've done that I think is most important is we have tried to resurrect the incredible wisdom and courage and visionary brilliance of the civil rights movement and remind this new generation of how great that organizing was and how much it can teach us today through a series of interviews.
Yeah, well, thanks, Terry. And we'll be back in just a minute. We're going to take a quick musical break. And this is Jess Clark reporting with the podcast StreetSpirit.org. And we're just going to take a quick break for stations to identify themselves.
Maybe you talked a little bit about who are some of the people
we'll be right back with more from Terry Messman on the approach to nonviolence and how the deep mission of Street Spirit, which is to promote really a transformational form of organizing, is really taking and having an impact.
Practice for decades, almost half a century in cases series, which interviews frontline activists, but also historical movers and shakers from the 20th century who are still living and still willing and able to bring that message to us now. Maybe you talk a little bit about who are some of the people, the great practitioners you've interviewed? What's the experience like being in the room with these people, and how you distill, hours of conversation with somebody like Lawson or Hartzell or these people that have been engaged in political practice for decades, almost half a century in cases, and then you're going to distill it down to 10 or 15 pages. That's still a monstrous big thing for a newspaper. So maybe just talk a little bit about A, who you've been talking to, and B, what's the process like in terms of getting inside the head of somebody that's looking at these issues and bringing forward something that you can distill to pass on to this next generation.
Well, remember, the key part of Street Spirit is giving a voice to the voiceless, and I discovered a troubling new dimension of voicelessness a few years ago. My wife and I visited the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, which is a just incredibly important museum in Birmingham, Alabama, that inside its doors is a living history of the civil rights movement. And we toured that, and it was an incredibly powerful experience. That museum is located right near the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, where Martin Luther King and Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth led those children to march on the city of Birmingham for justice. It's right across the street from Kelly Ingram Park, where Sheriff Bull Connor unleashed police dogs and water cannons and police with their brutal billy clubs on children and on clergy and on everyone else who stood up for justice. And you tour that, and it breaks your heart, because the 16th Street Baptist Church right across the street is where the Ku Klux Klan blew up four young Sunday school students and injured many more, and really helped Martin Luther King organize incredibly well against the naked face of brutality that Bull Connor showed in those terribly repressive days. And you feel that history around you. And while I was going through there, I saw the great courageous role that Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth played in Birmingham. Him and his family were threatened. He was beaten. They were threatened with bombing. They eventually had to leave the city, but he's also a hero in that city. So when we walked out of the museum, there was a statue to Fred Shuttlesworth there. And I had talked to people inside the museum that had known Fred Shuttlesworth, and I had this terrible sadness that he was not alive. He had just died the year before we visited, and I couldn't interview him. And then when we left Birmingham, we left out of the Fred Shuttlesworth Airport. So at the Civil Rights Movement, they took over the identity of Birmingham, the most racist city in the South, the city that was known as Bombingham because there were so many bombs. Well, they now have the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum, the Fred Shuttlesworth Airport. And I was really heartened by that, but really realized that I needed to interview some of these people before it was too late, and they became voiceless on the historic stage. So I've interviewed people like Dr. Bernard Lafayette, who was Martin Luther King's trusted lieutenant, who King asked to head up the Poor People's Campaign of 1968, and Dr. Lafayette was also instrumental in the Selma Voting Rights Campaign of 1965. I interviewed Vincent Harding, who was a very close friend of Martin Luther King and who actually wrote King's famous Beyond Vietnam speech that he gave at Riverside Church in New York City in 1967. And Vincent Harding has written two books about Martin Luther King, but more importantly, he wrote that speech for Dr. King that became such a lightning rod in King's career. And before that, Vincent had been an organizer against both nuclear weapons and war, and also against segregation in the early 60s, and then went on to have a really important career as a voice and an author of all of those values. He wrote the book, There is a River, about the struggles against slavery in the United States. So I interviewed him. I interviewed Reverend Phil Lawson, who is a pastor in the East Bay and the brother of Reverend Jim Lawson, who was just one of the most important figures in the civil rights movement. Well, so was Phil. Phil worked with so many areas of the civil rights movement, but then he continued working for economic justice in Richmond. And the interview I did with Phil Lawson, I still feel, is the most important single interview I've ever done. Just an amazing way that he interweaves all of the social change movements of the 20th century and shows the relationship between the struggle for immigrant rights and civil rights, the struggle for gay rights and African American rights. He put that all together so brilliantly. And I knew Phil because Reverend Phil Lawson had also been a mainstay and religious witness with homeless people and had slept out on the cold streets with us in solidarity with homeless people. He had been arrested at a abandoned housing takeover in East Oakland that I organized. And then I interviewed people like David Hartsoe and Jim and Shelley Douglas, who have been involved in an unbroken way for more than 50 years in the peace movement, the civil rights movement, and the anti-nuclear movement. They have so many lessons to give to today's activists, and I knew that I had to capture those lessons. How did they interweave the message of Gandhi and King and all of the other great nonviolent warriors for peace and justice and carry it forward into the anti-nuclear movement, the anti-Vietnam movement, and the struggle against the Trident nuclear submarine? And then I also interviewed Kathy Kelly, who is a remarkable activist that many people just deeply admire because she's spent months in federal prison for organizing against nuclear weapons and doing civil disobedience, but she has also worked with people in Afghanistan and Iraq, gone there over and over, violating U.S. law by carrying medical supplies to those people. And again, just like Reverend Lawson, Kathy Kelly interweaves all the movements until you begin to see it's all one movement. The movement against war, against racism, against poverty, against the kind of injustices done to immigrants or people that happen to live in Afghanistan, it's all one movement. It's a movement for the value of human life in the face of a system that deals death.
Now, in terms of the commonalities, they don't have to be universally common, but those were all nonviolent practitioners for the most part, their practice. And when you're looking at the actual substance of what they're saying, and you're looking at someone, is the linchpin a direct action and the willingness to risk one's own life and confrontation, or is it a big social movement organizing, a mass movement? You know, just what's the interplay between the priorities of a moral witness, which the Catholic workers and many others provided over the decades, but that didn't necessarily translate into a political movement that brought change. The nuclear weapons arsenal of the United States, while it certainly has scaled back from the tragedies of the mid-60s, it's still thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons, and they're upgrading them right now. So that there's a little bit of a disconnect between the moral stand and the effectiveness of it and the movement building. And I'm wondering, in terms of talking to those guys, how do they grapple with that contradiction?
There can be a disconnect, but I don't think there's a contradiction at all. And in fact, the anti-nuclear movement is a great example of that. Many of the first anti-nuclear activists were very much moved by a religious and moral personal witness and did incredibly brave things, like the people that sailed the Golden Rule right into the nuclear testing zone of the Pacific and tried to literally sacrifice their lives to prevent the atomic weapons testing that was polluting the entire world with radioactive chemicals. They were not just a one-shot moral witness. They inspired people for decades afterwards. They're still traveling around speaking and writing books about what they've done. And so you look at, say, a moral witness like Dorothy Day as a Catholic worker. Her Catholic workers in New York City refused to take cover during the scares over nuclear weapons when the government was forcing people to take shelter in civil defense drills to prepare themselves to survive the Holocaust, which is absurd. Well, Dorothy Day saw it as part of a nuclear warmongering society, refused to take shelter, and was arrested. That was a fairly small action, and yet it inspired so many people in a process that I call the chain reaction of conscience. And I think moving on, you see most clearly the linkage between the moral witness and the movement-building strategy. Jim and Shelley Douglas began doing very costly kinds of moral witness against the Trident nuclear submarine in the 1980s, in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And I was part of those protests. I was arrested at them and did time in federal prison for them. We would climb over the fence into the Bangor Naval Base and be arrested, do months in federal prison. We would walk inland to the nuclear weapons bunkers where Marines literally had shoot to kill orders, willing to risk our lives to say no to nuclear madness. And then we also did the Trident boat blockade in 1982 when the first USS Ohio came into Puget Sound, and there were about 50 of us out on the water in sailboats and rowboats. The US Navy sent 99 boats to destroy our little flotilla, and that was a bigger Navy than every other country in the world had that they mounted against us. And it was a brutal assault on us, and it was front page news all over. And you can say, okay, that's the moral witness, and that's fine and good, but what about the larger movement? But as Jim and Shelley Douglas were organizing these moral witnesses, they were inspiring people all over the country. So the next step in that campaign was when they found the white train carrying hydrogen warheads into the Bangor Naval Base, and they got hundreds of communities to sit on the tracks all over the country to block those train shipments. And they, in fact, stopped the Department of Energy from being able to ship nuclear weapons on the trains that were very dangerous. It was a very dangerous kind of shipment of radioactive warheads through all of our towns. People risked long jail sentences to stop them, and that got thousands of people involved. So you never know when a moral witness is going to provide the right strategy and the right inspiration to a larger movement. But they do. The fact is, they do. The Catholic left, like the Berrigan brothers that burned draft cards in the 1960s, were also tied to a massive movement against the Vietnam War. So I don't think it's either or. I don't think it's either a moral witness that a few people are willing to bravely make, or a mass movement organizing. I think it's both and. You need both. You need very militant actions that challenge the system, people willing to risk a lot, and you need the strategy that will then show thousands and then millions of people how they can participate. And as you recall, with the nuclear weapons movement, those few people that sailed their boats into the waters of the Pacific to stop nuclear testing, those few people that were arrested with Dorothy Day and protesting the civil defense drills, those became millions of people that voted for a nuclear freeze, that rallied outside the Pentagon and in Washington, D.C., that worked tirelessly for peace. And I think in the worst years of the Reagan era, I think that they were an incredibly important force. And it jumped the ocean. It spanned the continents. Europe began holding equally large and important protests against cruise and Pershing missiles and Trident submarines based in England. So I think the way that it has always worked is you need those few people that are willing to risk everything, and that inspiration can trigger a mass movement. I think it's always worked that way.
On the economic justice side, in terms of these people that you've been talking with, what are some of the moral stance, movement building synergies that you've seen, and where are they sort of potential and beginning to emerge or have the possibility for emerging, that you want to cultivate and bring to light using the newspaper and the other media you're building?
Well, I should say the most important thing I learned doing when I was hired by AFSC to work on homeless issues and doing Street Spirit all these years is that I love the homeless movement. I mean, it is, in a sense, the smallest and most beleaguered movement in the country, because even a lot of peace movement people, even a lot of social justice people, don't join the homeless movement. And I think they're often afflicted with the same prejudice, not the same kind, but the same prejudice that homeless people really are beside the point. They're out there languishing on the street and living in shelters and maybe can't be organized that well. Well, we did a ton of organizing in Oakland that shows they can be organized to do really intelligent actions. We won a lot of permanent housing, transitional housing, and emergency housing in Oakland by doing civil disobedience solely with homeless people. My approach in Oakland was not to invite any middle-class activists, but to work only with homeless people, because I wanted us to build our own home, our own movement. So I think, first of all, what I've fallen in love with working with the homeless movement is that all of the people I admire most are homeless activists. I mean, people that are homeless and are activists, people that have never been homeless but are activists in the homeless movement. They have a level of intelligence about economic justice issues, a level of intelligence about human rights and how to organize and what's important in the lives of poor and disabled people that really takes my breath away. Every time I go into a city and meet the homeless activists there, I'm incredibly moved. And I'm somebody that has always loved the social change movements. I mean, before this work with AFSC, I would have said my favorite people are the people in the religious peace movement. They have the deepest souls I've met. They are the deepest commitment and standing for all the right values. You know, all the kinds of people I've talked about, people willing to do plowshares actions or get arrested at nuclear weapons facilities like Livermore Lab. I still love that spirit. But I love the homeless movement even more because they are so much the underdogs, and they are so committed and dedicated. So when I think of how do we then build this large, glorious movement, I don't really think about that. I just think of how can I serve this homeless movement that is so ignored in our country. Having said that, there are a lot of ways you can build connections, and we have. We try to build connections with tenant movements because there are millions of tenants that face eviction and poor living circumstances and skyrocketing rents. Many of those tenants become homeless people. We've always tried to build connections with people fighting for the rights of those on welfare, people fighting for living wages that are being really screwed over by the corporate powers that be that will not pay them a livable wage. We've always made common cause with people that have a vision of economic justice, like Reverend Phil Lawson. He's always worked on all these larger issues of economic justice. When the Occupy movement came along, even though now in retrospect it kind of had its day in the sun and very quickly folded, and many of us were worrying about that and warning about that from day one in that movement, there was still an incredibly heartening uprising of young people. And I always used to say, if you go to an Occupy march, read the signs that these young people have created. It's a primer on economic justice. It's a primer against the banks and the corporate powers and Wall Street. It's like a class in economic justice in America just to read their signs. I would have never dreamed that was going to happen. And that just makes me understand something else about movements. You never know when the chain reaction of conscience will strike. People have done this work, done everything right strategies, right action, complete dedication for years, and have always been able to mobilize only the same choir, you know, preach to the same choir, organize, be arrested with the same group of people, and then all of a sudden, and I think for reasons that cannot be predicted ahead of time, a movement will blossom. The day will come, the spirit of the times will enable the movement to become bigger than you might have ever dreamed. I mean, we've seen that over and over in this country. You know, radicals working for justice in the 1930s suddenly become a massive labor union uprising. It's always happened that way. And I think for me, the lesson is not so much how you strategize and how you organize, although that's important. And I've done long trainings on how you strategize and organize. But to me, the most important thing is how do you stay inspired and stay faithful and stay true in the long run? Because that's going to be what matters. At the end, that is the meaning of our lives, whether we keep going, whether we keep fighting for justice or give up in despair. And it's the meaning of our lives whether we keep going long enough to pass the torch to the next generation that will rise up and learn all these lessons and live them out anew. And then those movements, in turn, will wither away, and people will despair about that.
This is a life cycle.
You never, ever should despair. There's always an ability to create a new movement for human rights, always.
Now this is a slightly parenthetical, but earlier you were mentioning the character of the people that you've met in the homeless movement. And this reflects something in my experience, too, because I worked 7 or 8 years in the Tenderloin. I worked another 7 years training low-income people in journalism. And the intelligence, you talked about the class analysis, the instinctive. Obviously, you've already lost everything. You have a class analysis that can't be beat. But there's a lot of essential humanity that we get to encounter in these situations. Now, maybe you could talk about, you know, you have the sung heroes like Lawson, even if they're relatively unsung in the mainstream. You have the sung heroes like Lawson and Hartso and Kelly, but then maybe you can just talk about some of the personalities. I mean, I remember the cartoonist Duncan that you guys used to run, yeah. And some of the people that live out on the street and preach to the street and move the street and serve the street. Just some of those human beings and some of the stories of how you've interacted with them through the paper, through Project Hope, and your organizing.
Well, that's a good phrase. The sung and the unsung. The unsung heroes and heroines is exactly how I conceive of it. I mean, when I began working in Oakland, I was a veteran nonviolent trainer. We do these day-long or two-day-long nonviolent training sessions. And American Friends Service Committee wanted me to go into Oakland, into poor and black neighborhoods, and do those trainings. And people were very respectful and seemed to get a lot out of them. I quit doing them right away because I realized they were just not needed. It is so strange, but the black community in Oakland knew all that stuff. I couldn't teach them a thing about peace or militarism. I couldn't teach them a thing about economic justice. They were already there. They knew all that stuff. They had lived that stuff. When you're on the wrong side of the empire, the wrong side of capitalism, you learn that stuff. You know about the banks, you know about racism, you know about injustice and how the military takes the sons and daughters of poor people to fight their wars overseas for their own purposes, and then those veterans end up homeless and disabled on the streets. They knew all that. They didn't need me to train. What they needed was just a friend and an ally to organize actions with them. And what I learned was such an incredible respect for the people that had walked this walk. I mean, in Oakland, I got to meet Dorothy King, and she had been homeless due to domestic violence, and she was a fighter. She was a very moral person that kind of insisted on moral accountability, so I called her the middle-class conscience of the homeless union. But she was also a fighter, and she was a brilliant organizer. I mean, she taught me, I think more than any other single person has taught me, about how you organize, how you make sure that homeless people are a majority on the board of a housing corporation we formed, how you make sure that African Americans are not cheated out of the jobs that arise out of what we create, the things you fight for with all your heart. And she did fight with everything she had. So did Gerald Waldron and Andrew Jackson and T.N. Gray. All these people were mainstays of the Oakland Union of the Homeless. They were all homeless. None of them were veteran organizers, and yet they were the best people I have worked with in my life. The most faithful, the most completely committed. We would organize a housing takeover with a day notice, and they were there, bang. They were there with their boots on and ready to be arrested, and totally wonderful, lively spirits, and people that were facing every kind of bad thing in life, eviction notice, substance abuse, marital breakups, but when it was time to march on the welfare office or take over an abandoned federal building in Oakland, we got arrested on the ceiling of this large vacant federal building in one of our most important actions. We planned that in a day, and people were ready. I mean, I've never seen that in... I hate to use the word middle-class activists because they're not all middle-class, but many of them are, and a lot of them have tons of dedication, but I have never seen the dedication I saw in those people. And that carries forward in this day, you know. The people that work with the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco, the people that just carried out the Liberty City occupation in Berkeley. I mean, that occupation was so instructive because a couple people like Sally Hindman were really responsible were caring about the criminalization of homelessness in Berkeley, and Sally insisted on doing a sleep out. And I didn't even think we had the energy to do it. And it was a very small effort. Sally and Moni Law and a few other people did this sleep out of about five persons on the steps of old Berkeley City Hall the night before the city council passed these sickening and brutal anti-homeless ordinances by a 6-3 majority. It was a terrible blow, but it was beautiful because hundreds of people spoke out against the anti-homeless laws. Well, that would have been the end of it, except a bunch of homeless people came and saw that a few people had done a sleep out, and they put their tents up all over Berkeley City Hall and stayed there for weeks in a self-governing encampment, governed by consensus, dedicated to no drugs, no alcohol, and ongoing organizing until the Berkeley cops raided them. And the amount of suffering it takes to sleep out like that. I mean, the activists that slept out for one night were brutalized by the experience. They were up all night by the noisiness of the streets, the freezing weather. This was in late November, early December. And it was a terrible ordeal for them for one or two nights. And then all these homeless people come in, and dozens of them sleep there night after night, and they get up and organize all day. I mean, it tells you something. It tells you something remarkable about the human spirit, that poverty doesn't weigh it down. And yet, can you get middle-class activists in this country even to understand that, peace and justice activists to understand that, that they could make common cause with the people that are forced to sleep outdoors all over this country? No. They're not there yet. Even with the Occupy movement, there was very little solidarity with the homeless movement. Very little. Even though all their rhetoric was right on, even though their direction and their inspiration were admirable, they didn't mostly include homeless people. They didn't find a way to do that. And we found a way to do it in Oakland. We did the long march from civil disobedience to housing takeovers to actually running our own housing program. And if we did it, anybody can do it, because we were a ragtag handful. And yet, many people have said that's one of the only examples where people have ever done the march from protest on the streets to creating housing. But it could be done anywhere, literally, if we could do it. And all these middle-class activists could make common cause with homeless people. And I thought that was going to happen when Occupy hit the streets, but it has still never happened to this day. Someday it'll happen. Someday there will be a movement, I predict, where the tenants will join with the homeless people. Those evicted will join with those about to be evicted. They'll join with the low-wage workers, and they'll join with all these idealistic young people that care about human rights, and there will be a movement. And that will be the movement that I'm waiting for. That's the movement Martin Luther King tried to organize in 1968. And what baffles me endlessly is why people don't want to resurrect the poor people's movement that King did. Everybody gives lip service to what a great leader he was. He was more than that. He was a brilliant strategist. Him and his whole team, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they were brilliant organizers. And King's last message, his last prophetic message, was a blueprint for social change. He said, we have to fight racism and militarism and poverty all at once. And where it begins is a poor people's campaign that also peace activists and labor union activists and poor people's and religious activists all join together and force a movement for economic justice. And then we'll see social change. And people think King was a prophet. Why don't they look at what the prophet was doing when the prophet was assassinated on April 4th of 1968? He was building up to the poor people's encampment in Washington, D.C. And the only echo of that legacy I see, there are many other great parts of Martin Luther King's legacy and all the other great civil rights organizers. They've left us a beautiful legacy. But the only echoes of King's final legacy of building that poor people's campaign that I have seen in my lifetime are all the homeless sleepouts and protests and housing takeovers that I have witnessed.
Those the resurrection
are the, those
cities.
Are the ones carrying that on.
In the model of the resurrection city. Yeah. That happened after King was shot
yeah.
in Washington.
It's a resurrection of Resurrection City, and you're right. King was gunned down on April 4th of 68, and Resurrection City People were brokenhearted and despairing by his assassination, and yet they carried out Resurrection City anyway. 50,000 people in Washington, D.C. Many positive strides forward for hungry people were made in Resurrection City. It also helped kickstart a welfare rights campaign. But King's assassination and Bobby Kennedy's assassination right afterwards tore the heart out of people. But we should have recovered by now. There should be a resurrection of Resurrection City, because it was King's last best dream. He was right, people. If you want to do the right thing in America, look at Martin Luther King right before he was gunned down in April of 1968 and ask what he was doing. He was in solidarity with striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, and when he was killed, and he was building a poor people's movement in Washington, D.C. And those are the things that need to be resurrected.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us. That was a great interview.
Thank you.
And we'll be back next time with more from Street Spirit, homeless news, and social justice blues in the San Francisco Bay Area. Thanks for joining us.